like to go over scheduling. Provided members with a rough schedule so that we can look ahead a little bit. A couple of errors on it. I'll call them errors. Down around in November, you'll see November 28th as a date for presentations. I don't think that's a good idea. That's Thanksgiving. And so that should be November 21. And just informational item, December 15th is a Sunday, I'm told, so I believe the deadline for reporting would become December 16th, my understanding. So on the agenda, the scheduling, we're now August 29. We'll go through today's presentations. And our next meeting will be September 12th. And what I put on here is a public hearing, an opportunity for people beyond the selected few that we've had present to us to provide us with input on what we ought to be doing, on the scope of our mandate, on what should be included as regulatory elements in a best practices bill for expanded gaming, that kind of thing. And I'm completely open to discussion on that, whether we should go forward with that at this time. Is a fair question. I invite your comments, your suggestions, your point of view on that.
I had only one comment, which is that we're anticipating having an executive session at that point, a non-public session at that point, on discussion of the bids submitted. And if we are also having a public hearing, those may both be lengthy. And I think we need to structure notice for the public hearing in such a way that we don't have members of the public sitting around for a long period of time while we're discussing other stuff. And I don't know which one you want to do first, whether you want to do the request for proposal, but I suspect it may take us longer than our normal 3 hours on that date.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes.
The proposals will come from national firms and likely be time zone sensitive as well. So that may weigh into your conversation in terms of timing, scheduling, conversations with consultants.
Oh, I see. Well, that's a good point. I think it's another reason to schedule a second date for the consideration of the RFP as a separate time. So let's assume we do that for the moment, and let's focus on the hearing. Any other thoughts on that? Shall we go forward with the hearing? Get nodded heads? Nodding. Okay. And then, what's your pleasure on a separate meeting for RFPs? It would be a meeting where we'd open in public session, but go immediately into executive session. We could do it on the same day at a different hour. We could choose a different day. Always difficult. We don't get bids until September 6th, the end of the day. We could schedule a meeting for Tuesday following that, which would be the 10th, I believe, of September. Did that work for people if we did that?
I could do the 10th.
Is Mr. Chairman talking about doing it at 9 o'clock in the morning again?
Is that all right, or would you prefer a different time?
No, I'm just trying. I do have a meeting that starts at noon in Manchester. That it's my monthly partnership meeting, which goes from noon till 2. So it may mean I'm not here for the entire meeting, if it, you know, but...
We start at 9.
Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chair, I won't be in the state the 10th, but I can certainly send a designee if that's the committee's consideration.
Okay. Why don't we do it that way? Yeah. All right, then we'll plan on that, September 10th. And we will go forward with the public hearing. I have no idea whether we need a room this size or room larger than this or smaller than this? I just, anybody have any way of gauging that? I think this would be big enough if we can get this run. So I'll arrange that. Any other thoughts on I think as we move forward in time, we'll start seeing how the rest of the schedules will fill out, and it will take shape perhaps in a different way than it's laid out here. It's just a way of getting a sense of time frame and what we're up against and when we should be starting certain parts of our work. But I think we'll learn a lot more as we go along. So we can move on from that. I don't think we need a vote on that. I think the Racing and Charlotte Gaming Commission wanted to share a few items with us as follow-up from their presentation.
About a 30-month snapshot. There were about 7 monetary fines totaling $10,900. Statutorily, the commission does not have the authority to find a bingo or lucky 7, so this would be the game's chance only. Number 2, number of cases referred to the potential criminal nature. About 3, not including the internet cafes, which were subsequently outlawed.
This again over a 30-month period?
About 30-month period, yeah. Correct, the whole report is. Question 3 was a number of warning letters we issued. They issued about 173 warning letters. Question 4, the number of hearings held before the commission. The commission held 33 hearings. Day before yesterday, held 4 more. 5 was the matrix regarding cash deviation is acceptable during audits. And a matrix system is not used, but rather a review of any anomalies or numbers that cannot be reasonably explained as being higher or lower than expected by the auditors. 6, receive a handout that's attached. I'll just give you some licensing summaries of all the licenses that we issue. And question 7 was about the Maine Charitable Gaming. Charitable Gaming in Maine is under the oversight of the state police, the Maine State Police, and we were unsuccessful in obtaining any financial information, although numerous attempts were made by email, but we were unsuccessful in getting the numbers. I think HHF in Maine, the numbers are reported, the charity revenues. They don't pass it out as far as charitable gaming we could detect. So that was my homework.
Thank you. Anything from the Lottery Commission?
No, just that you should have received an email from me and then follow up. There's a thumb drive, if you wish to take one as well, for the lottery's rules, the administrative rules approved by JLCAR, the rules that govern the number of games that we offer, those bylaws that govern those games, as well as the multi-state agreements that we've entered into with the New England states, the tri-state, which is Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, as well as MUSL, which is 34 states across the U.S. and the Virgin Islands. So if you have any questions, certainly feel free. It's a voluminous amount of data. I didn't want to burden you with paper.
And the thumb drives?
Yes, they're thumb drives. These are USB port devices that enter into a computer and it should load as a external memory device.
So pick them up from you?
Certainly, yes. I've handed out several this morning.
Oh, you've done that?
Yes, if you wish to use them. Yeah. And, oh, certainly. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
All right. So we're all set to go forward with the Department of Safety, I think, on law enforcement issues related to current gambling and New Hampshire and specifically the state police. Thank you. Yes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Be so kind of to distribute the handout.
Yes.
Yeah. I get one.
Maybe. No, I think you can present to the board, as long as you speak loudly for the audience.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. In regards to Department of Safety, I'm standing in today for Commissioner John Bottomless. I was asked to present on some safety matters relating to casinos, so what I did was I prepared an overview of a cross-section of what they're seeing for crime in other casinos. And on my handout, which was done by the Intelligence and Analysis Center, our ICAC, I addressed Connecticut, Delaware, New Jersey, we looked at the state of Maine. And I won't go through each and every one of these, it's there for your review, but what you will see is in these different casinos, this handout outlines the number of facilities within the casino designation operating within each respective state, the number of casino-related hotels and rooms within the state. And for this handout, its rooms and hotels are included are only those directly attached to the casino or resort. A hotel that's located off the premises is not attached. The number of table games and slot-side video machines in each one of these. Most states and casinos are classifying table games and poker tables as being in different categories. This handout treats them similarly and uniformly. The number of casino-related amenities, specifically the number of restaurants, bars, nightclubs attached to each casino. This may include facilities of prominence such as tracks or arenas. The estimated patronage of casinos statewide annually per casino breakdowns are not included here. Criminal activity, which I think Mr. Chair, you're more interested in. The criminal activity is broken down, and these are current statistics up to date as of yesterday. Now, what you'll see in these different facilities, and I'll just point to Connecticut. Now, Connecticut has two major facilities, Fortunes and the Eco Center. Calls for service, these are annual, 11,000 calls, investigations, 1,000, arrests, 864. Majority of include trespassing, public disturbance, larceny, those types of crimes. 13% rise to the felony level. And as you go through, you'll see similar stats from Delaware, three facilities there, Harrington Raceway, Delaware Park, Dover Downs. Differing is rooms. If you look, I point to Connecticut, Foxwoods, Zoom, or Eagle Suns. One thing that jumps out of these rooms, 3,466 across five hotels. 500 rooms in one hotel in Delaware. And the crimes are somewhat reduced. Criminal violations, incidents, 340 in Delaware. And again, trespassing, theft, disorderly, etc. Going over to New Jersey, number of facilities, 12. 8 plus, Valleys, Regatta, Taj Mahal, and Trump Plaza. Again, as you look down at the handout, Mr. Chair, you'll see the number of nightclubs, number of table games, number of slots, number of hotels, number of rooms, and the crime related. And then lastly, we follow up with the state of Maine, which their facilities, Hollywood Casino and Oxford Casino. And again, the number of rooms is reduced and the number of arrests significantly reduced. I just offered that to your review. I would like to point out to the commission that each one of these states, I've been in contact with either their colonels or the command staff officer in charge, and I can get any additional information that the board may request updated. In regards to this handout, Mr. Chair, is that sufficient for you? Or do you have any questions of these statistics, sir?
I don't right now. I think our focus at this moment in time is more what's going on in New Hampshire today. So if you have any information on that,
you
can go to that.
Okay, sir. Moving forward, we talked on the topic of gambling. I think we're all familiar with the statute 647.2. I meet regularly and network with Mr. Kelly. I understand the statute that he has to work on in his investigations. But what I will tell you, and I would suggest that you at some point If you want to inquire from some of the largest city chiefs and see what they're seeing at their level, whether it be Manchester, Nashville, or some of the biggest cities in the state. But what we are getting on an intelligence front is illegal taking place in all counties across the state. Illegal gambling can differ from the video machines, bookmaking, card games, that type of activity. What I will tell you is this, speaking solely for the state police, in years past, we targeted some of these operations. I was a member of the unit prior to those folks going over to Mr. Kelly's shop. I actually was in charge of that for a brief period of time. We were engaged in some bookmaking operations. We did these video slot machines. These cases ended up themselves, and I'll specifically speak to the slot machines. They're requiring in-depth investigation, which requires you generally to get a cooperating source who will bring an undercover officer in to actually play the machine, to actually get a payoff. Evidence needs to be acquired, whether it's recorded conversation, video surveillance, that type of evidence. Some of those rise to the level of a misdemeanor under 647:2, and some rise to the level of a felony if you can prove gross revenue over $2,000, an ongoing operation in excess of 30 days, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess for the commission, it's a very comprehensive investigation, somewhat similar to making an undercover drug purchase. You need an informant. You need buy funds, and you need to get the evidence, corroborating evidence that will lead to a successful prosecution. The bookmaking operations, those in and of themselves generally rise to the level of tape recorded phone calls, confidential sources. Some may lead to intercepts, telephone intercepts, commonly referred to as wiretaps. We on the state police have not focused on those types of investigations, and our resources, our undercover resources, have been more focused on narcotics. With the rise of prescription drug abuse overdose, so we've generally been targeting and concentrating on those more over the last 7 years.
So you don't have resources right now allocated to, you don't have sufficient resources to address this particular problem.
Correct. And it's a difficult case to put together. It's similar to a narcotics case. So what are we seeing throughout the state? It does exist. Are we concentrating our efforts to combat it, whether it's at the level of the machine, the card game, internet gambling, or bookmaking at a higher level? I would say no.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think for the benefit of our reporters, I hope we're very good at math, because you start looking through these, and you'll have to be a mathematician in order to extrapolate what the incidences are, because you have to figure out how many people are attending the facilities in Connecticut versus the number in Delaware and the number of Maine. So as a percent of visitations, that's the only way you'll be able to figure out what the investigations are and what the actual number means on an incident, because it has to be pertinent to the number of people who are attending. And then if you also want to extrapolate, you better look at what the New Hampshire Racing and Gaming Commission just did on the number of licenses. We have 1,392 people who are participating in gaming in the state of New Hampshire. I would say that somewhat far exceeds everything I see on this chart. Numbers are interesting until you dive into them, and when we report these things, I think it has to be reported on what the actual real numbers are and what we actually already have in the state of New Hampshire. We have, what, primary game operators, 74, games of chance organizations, 389. I mean, I don't know. I would say that's quite a bit of gambling in the state of New Hampshire. We don't receive near the amount of money for the state, as Maine, Connecticut. I don't want to go to New Jersey because I don't go to New Jersey, but I'm not going to compare New Hampshire to anything in New Jersey. But I think it's very interesting when we report these things that on a statistical basis, everybody understands how to do math because you can't extrapolate unless you do the math on these things.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering when, just so I'm comparing apples and apples also, when we look at the criminal violations for other states, are those violations within a certain geographical area, or are they ones that we know are related to the casinos, or are they statewide?
No, these are related to the casinos.
Okay.
And this was done rather quickly, but the Intelligence and Analysis Center, our intelligence folks, called out there and said, can we have some current statistics? I had got some approximately a year ago, so we just tried to update them. So these aren't exact, but it kind of gives you a flavor for how big the facility is, what's the handle, the volume.
So if I were looking at calls for service in Connecticut, that would mean calls for service actually at the casino or the attached complex.
Right.
Okay,
yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, you know, two aggregate, so for
both. Okay, yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions, Ed. You may not know the answers to this, which is okay. Do you have any insight into it seems there's a big difference in numbers between New Jersey and Connecticut, but the number of visitors is very similar, yet Connecticut had, it seems, many more calls for service and almost 2.5 times as many arrests. Do you have any idea why that is?
I don't, but I think this professional Senator Rob should say.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at what is an incident.
Yeah.
You know, what may a call for service, they can be different, but I think I think the arrest, quite frankly, speak for themselves, but how they handle their, what the private security will handle, what will law enforcement handle, but what I see a common theme is you see that we could be public nuisance,
type
crimes, and trespass,
and
disorderly
conduct. My next question is, and this is probably just so difficult to analyze, but in terms of the illegal gambling that you know we have here in New Hampshire, is there comparable illegal gambling going on in these four states you've looked at, or?
Well, that's interesting. I was having a conversation with the general this morning, and he asked the same question. I've asked my intelligence officers to make a call and say, once these casinos are up and running, have you seen a decrease in these types of, you know, table games and illegal slot games? So we will look into that and provide that information to the Attorney General at that point.
Okay. And then this is my last question, and this is probably not a question for you. It may be for one of the other members of the authority. Do these four states have the charitable gaming such as we have here in New Hampshire, or not? Does anyone know?
Three of them do.
To the same volume as we have in New Hampshire?
I don't know. Connecticut, the casinos in Connecticut were authorized because of charitable gambling. It was a case out of California called Cabezan Indians, which generated a sort of Indian gaming world, which then was regulated by the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act.
Yeah.
So Connecticut allowed casino gambling prior to this passage of that federal bill because charitable gambling had been going on, and the federal court said, you have two sovereigns in your state boundaries. Therefore, you have to treat them the same.
Mm-hmm.
If you allow this type of gambling in states through tribal means, you have to allow it for the tribes as well.
Oh, I see. So it might be possible to find out, for example, in Connecticut, was there a reduction? Or
sure.
No? Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I have several questions if I could run through them.
Go right ahead. Thank you.
Colonel, thank you. Were you able to relate the difference between sort of crimes of convenience versus those that are specifically related to the casino itself? Meaning, were state police or law enforcement called at the casino because it was the closest place available where law enforcement existed?
Well, if I understand, like I know Connecticut has troopers on site that are working. Yeah. They have private security. Sometimes something crosses the threshold of the security officer can't handle the private security guard, and the trooper will step in. Other facilities sometimes don't have troopers on site, but they'll call somebody in. Is that your question?
It is, yes.
Yes, and I think the same exists in Maine.
Okay.
And I think, you know, when I was asked to look at what it would take to staff to properly, you know, ensure safe operation and conduct in the casino, when I called around to my counterparts in these other states, the first thing they said to me is, Colonel, you need to understand what are they building, how many rooms, how big, how many liquor establishments, what's the amount of people. Because in Connecticut, at a big event that draws in a number of people, they may deal with a lot of issues related to alcohol and, you know, disturbances, that type of thing.
And did you notice a correlation between the assets in place for law enforcement and a correlation between the amount of crime that occurred at that establishment?
I did not. What the common theme I heard is there has to be good synergy between law enforcement and private security, because the majority of the crimes that take place, the evidence is in the video, which is controlled and manned primarily by the private security. So good synergy needs to exist. I heard that from
Is there a New Hampshire State Police Special Operations Unit or Special Investigations Unit that handles sort of organized criminal conduct?
Well, as I was testifying previously, we used to have a special, we used to have like a special unit that did the non-drug offenses, auto theft, gambling, those types of offenses. We don't have that anymore. We have the ability to handle covert operations, but as I stated, based on the increase in the narcotics issues that we're seeing, those resources are being focused
sure.
on that.
So, like for example, the number of Title III applications for wiretaps, which I don't know if there's a state law requiring you notify, have there been any that you can discuss?
No,
for?
I would not discuss it.
Yeah,
do we have the ability to conduct them?
Yes. In Massachusetts, there's a comparable, if you file for a wiretap application to 7299 of the statutes in Mass, but Title III under federal, you have to disclose to the state clerk, essentially, that you've done so, not disclosing how many or where they were, essentially. There's no New Hampshire comparable?
I defer to the attorney. I know we have a statute in the state. We operate under state authority
yeah.
at times, and then under federal authority, depending on what type of case.
Yeah. And is there any cross prosecutions with the U.S. Attorney's Office? And one of the reasons I suggest that is, as a prosecutor, there's federal laws allowing for the forfeiture of assets used in illegal gaming for gambling that is not, at least not in other states, available to law enforcement, which serves as a dissuade to people to do that.
Yes, we have an excellent working relationship with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I've been involved in numerous myself cases that originate on the state level, but eventually the prosecution we determine together between the, you know, the Attorney General's Office and the U.S. Attorney's that it's handled federally. So that does occur.
But in terms of like forfeiture of assets, does that occur?
Yeah. There's criminal and there's civil statutes in the U.S. Attorney's Office today, many of our cases today. We have the opportunity to have them under the state statute for forfeiture,
sure.
or under the federal, criminal or civil. So generally we go where the best prosecution.
Oh, sure, of course.
Okay.
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
I'll just raise two more questions in my mind. First one is, criminal complaints in New Hampshire at the legal gaming facilities, do we have any figures on that? Not the, not illegal gaming, but with legal gaming facilities such as, yeah, the calls for service or investigations arising from any offenses taking place at those.
I think that question should be directed to Mr. Kelly.
Well, the question is, when we speak at two levels, there's an administrative issue going on. If we have a customer complaint that bingo call in period 3, not in mm-hmm. period 4, clearly that's administrative.
Right.
We'll see if it compliance. If we find something that looks like it is criminal nature, then we do, as I said, we refer it over to our counterpart, the Attorney General's Office.
No, what I'm talking about, though, is the drunken, disorderly, the larceny, you know, the
that's Absolutely.
You know, the customers, so to speak, getting it, causing issues at these facilities.
And you know what, ma'am? I think what I can do is I can reach out to some of the local chiefs.
Okay.
And we can get that information, what they're seeing at the facilities at the local level. And I'll also provide that for the next meeting.
Okay.
That'd
be great. Thank you very much. And then my second one was, do you see generally an increase or a number of incidents around sort of entertainment venues, like if there's an event at the Verizon or concerts at, I can't remember the name of the concert facility up in the Gilbert area, but those types of things, do they typically generate these types of service calls in terms of drunken, disorderly, trespass, that type of thing?
Again, what I'll speak to is what I'm involved
yeah.
in. Again, I think that the big city chiefs mm-hmm. should at some point be available to answer those questions. But with adequate law enforcement response, proper planning, mm-hmm. proper deployment of resources, we have many major events throughout the state that are handled safely and peacefully. So I think the key is to know what your target audience mm-hmm. is and to be properly planned and prepared, and whether it's a major event that track allowed in or
right.
you know, there's significant events throughout the state. So mm-hmm. I think the key is proper preparation and planning and threat assessments.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, Colonel Clark, for coming this morning and for all the data. This is just to expand on what Attorney Sullivan said. If it's possible to ask the analysis here, you can provide some more historical data on this. As we like to say, this is a snapshot of the last year. I've only speculated about the New Jersey natural disasters that occurred, perhaps would possibly account for lower arrests at a casino venue or things along those lines. But looking at historical data, as well as when some of these casinos or establishments were constructed. Sometimes crime data is available only for a certain period of time, the last 5 or 10 years, when the casino was built. But I'd be interested to see how the crime data trends over, say, a set period of time, if the analysis unit is able to obtain that information.
They are, and I'd be happy to have you work directly with them and specifically give them the request for what have you looking for the time period. But that's a resource there, and they'd be more than happy to work on that. I think the data is critical. And again, like I said, we put this together fairly quickly in today's meeting, but they will do that.
Any other questions? Very helpful. There's some follow-up to do, and that's good. I think it would be very interesting for us to hear from some of the chiefs of police in due course. And I've made a note of that.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. All right. We're doing pretty well, 5:10. And I have on my agenda Representative Gianni. See you. Yes, we've got copies of your bill which we're going to hand around. So just hold on. And we're entering into a time period here where we're going to be learning about the main legislative proposals that were put forward during this legislative session. And starting with House Bill 665. Representative GNA was the prime sponsor for that. There were other sponsors. After a brief report from Representative GNA, we'll go to Senate Bill 152, starting, it's actually backwards, but with this is the way the scheduling worked out with the so-called Omnibus Amendment to Senate Bill 152. And then we'll cycle back to Senate Bill 152 and hear from Senator Alessandro. We'll be giving more space, more time for the middle presentation, the Omnibus Amendment, basically because that was the most ambitious effort thus far to flesh out regulatory provisions, for better or for worse, related to expanded casino gambling. So we wanted to go through those carefully and make sure that we understood what had been put forward and why. And so that's the context for your presentation, Representative. We're delighted that you're here and appreciate your your willingness to come forward and tell us about what you were trying to accomplish.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you said, I am Representative Person 3 at Norman today, and I brought 665 in after many years of research and listening to my constituents, knowing the problems that we face. I thought it was a simple bill, had no fat, no politics, no favoritism. And what it did, it was a formula that would have brought forward the potential for $400 million and over 4,000 jobs for the state of New Hampshire. The money was to go directly to the highway department because we have a major problem with our highways and bridges. And at the same time, we had 45,000 people out of work at that time, 4,400, 4,500 up in the co-op, Grafton, and co-op. By putting this money into the highway department, these contracts could have been put out, and we could have put our people to work right away, and at the same time take care of a major issue that was facing us without bringing forward any new taxes. That was the whole reason and the rationale behind this bill. It wasn't done recklessly. It was done over a period of 12 years. I met with the CEOs of various gambling casinos, most recently the one up in Bangor, Maine. The information that I got up was firsthand. It wasn't secondhand. It wasn't gossip. I went to the chief of police. I went to the CEO of the casino, and I went to the mayor of Bangor. And all the facts that they presented appeared to be factual, very honest, forthcoming. They had no problem with problematic gambling and addictive gambling. They put thousands of dollars into a kitty for a number of years, and they finally stopped putting money into it because there were no takers. However, since then, they've created a fund again in anticipation that maybe sometime there will be. In addition to that, I don't know what else to tell you except this is a very simple bill that had all the checks and balances for us to get started. I think we've had our head in the sand too long. We've wasted too much time. The turnaround from the time any legislation is enacted until it becomes a reality, obviously, is time-consuming. And we're years behind the eight ball here. This is my constituent speaking. The state of New Hampshire has spoke. There's at least 82% of the state of New Hampshire overall that is behind some form of gambling in New Hampshire. And the formula that I brought forward is one that was recommended by the experts in the past that said the best formula for New Hampshire are two destination casinos, one along the Mass border and one off of Route 3 in the White Mountains. And the reason for this is that up in the White Mountains, the demographics are completely different than what you've got along the Mass border. The people that visit us because we are a destination recreation area. And it's the natural resources that we have that attracts them, nothing else. And we have the infrastructure, we have the land, we have a community up there that's willing and ready to move forward. Not to say that we'd get anyone that would participate, but the fact that there would be two destination casinos in the bill would get the additional support that's needed because of the feelings that are generated where they feel that the monopoly is directed here to the southern part of the state. Understand that given the difference in the demographics, that the Massachusetts people are not a threat to us. We got people from all over the world. Currently we have over 8 million people up there that were spending over 730 some odd million dollars. And they're not there because of Suffolk Downs or the mass population. They're there because, as I said before, it's what we have to offer to them. I was met with Mr. Worthen. He had asked to meet with me before the Senate Bill 152 was read to see if maybe I sense that maybe he would change my mind on if he's using his formula rather than mine. It didn't work, obviously. But I did support this because we got to get started. We've been dragging our feet, and the ideal thing is that my bill, I think, for all practical purposes, is the bill that should have been considered, should have been brought forward. And when I testified originally, I said that the numbers that I used in my bill, the fees, were discretionary in nature. They were numbers that were just put there that would have been refined by people like Mr. McIntyre here at the Lottery Commission, who is well-versed, well-educated, and knows how to handle gambling operations. I was looking for these numbers to come a little bit as we got into the middle of this program. I never got the opportunity. I did verbally testify before Ways and Means. I probably spent almost 3 hours one afternoon, and it's pretty hard to testify before a committee that has a chair and a vice chair that's on record as being anti-gambling. It just does not work. You know, I don't understand why the message that comes from my constituents doesn't come forward with the people that are elected to represent them. I might sound like I'm a little upset. I am. I'm greatly upset because I've seen this work. I've been in politics for most of my life. I'm just an 82-year-old kicking around from the White Mountains. But I've been connected to government and my people, and I've worked very hard to try to help them. I feel very bad when I have to go back and tell them, you know, we've got probably 29, 30 votes between here and the Canadian border. All power is down here. But common sense should dictate policy, and I guess, Mr. Chairman, other than that, there isn't much more I can say, except that 665 should have gotten more mileage than it did. It should have got us right off first base onto a home run here for a good thing to help our people, help our economy, fix the problems that we have. If there's anything I can do or any questions I can answer, I'll answer them to the best of my ability.
Sure. Well, thank you. Pretty fit, 82. A very fit 82-year-old.
Oh, thank you.
One of the questions that's put to this authority by its legislation is a question related to agency structure. But how should gambling be regulated from the point of view of oversight agencies in New Hampshire? The question that we're asked relates both to current gaming as well as expanded gaming. So we're supposed to look at that question as it applies to what's going on today in New Hampshire, and then we're supposed to look at that question as it applies to significantly expanded gaming. And I noticed in your bill you chose to go with the current structure and to give a new realm of authority to the Lottery Commission, which would be the casinos that you propose. Was there a reason for that?
Yes, the expertise lies within that division. Actually, the person in charge right now has a great background in gambling. He knows how to check them out. He knows where the money's going. He knows how to handle the people that work under him. He has an existing facility up there where the Lottery Commission is, but very few staff people, additional staff people, would be adequate and efficient to manage this operation. That's the whole rationale behind that. You may have noticed, that's the question that you asked. I'll answer that one. I'd love to ramble on.
Okay. questions from 30 members?
Yeah, over here.
Oh. Yeah.
Just to follow up on your question, because I don't spend a lot of time, no time in Concord, actually, so I was interested in how the structure has come about with lottery, because it seems to me that the Lottery Commission has a job of actually itself engaging in gambling activities through the sale of lottery tickets and overseeing sales of lottery tickets and the multi-state games. And so to have the Lottery Commission, which is itself engaged in the business of gambling, overseeing the business of gambling, seemed somewhat counterintuitive to me. And was there ever thought of having the regulatory authority up here instead of having the Lottery Commission sort of underneath it, as opposed to the opposite way the bill is structured? Because would you not want to have a regulatory authority regulating the activities of all the entities engaging in gaming, which would include private, charitable, and the lottery? It seemed that there was it should be reversed to me, but again, I'm not having your involvement in all this, so I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, if I understand your question correctly, you're saying you're kind of putting the fox in with the chickens?
No, because I don't consider them to be the fox, but it's the sense of, you know, the Lottery Commission's job is to sell and encourage gaming, and then, which is what these private entities would be doing and are doing. So if in a perfect world, would you not have one regulatory authority over all the entities engaging in gaming? One of which is this would be a state.
Admittedly, I'm not astute enough to put that, to synchronize that and put it in action. What I'm looking for is a formula that will work. Our people, such as yourselves, will decide whether or not that you need that sort of management. Mm-hmm. I felt very comfortable after speaking to Mr. McIntyre, having talked with a lot of other people, that the expertise lies in it. Mm-hmm. Once we get started, obviously, there will be some critiquing and there will be some rearrangement of things. But I felt the way I brought it forward that it was great, that it would work.
Mm-hmm.
Get us started. We got to get moving. I don't know that answers your question, but I felt very comfortable with that, and I've talked about it with many other people, and they seem to agree with me until time came to vote.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate all your efforts on this.
Well, thank you.
Other questions? Well,
Mr. Chairman, with your permission.
Yes.
And I don't want to aggravate or alienate any support for this bill. You'll notice in my bill that there was no room for charitable gaming. I want to explain that to you.
Okay.
Charitable gaming does not really hire people. Charitable gaming comes into a town, and they'll get someone to sponsor them, and then, for lack of any other term, they'll throw them a bone for doing this. That takes away from the whole thing. This bill that I brought forward is a job creation bill, and it's a new revenue source bill. And I just thought maybe when some of you go through this bill and see that that was not in there, you'd wonder why it wasn't, because Avalanche VF, Avalanche Legion, Rotary, all these fraternal and social organizations, and it's nice, particularly military organizations that have lost a lot of business because of our strong drinking laws, and maybe for good reason, but you know, when somebody comes in and asks them to sponsor something like this, and they get $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 to amortize their mortgages, they're very happy. But in reality, they're not employing anybody, and they aren't really doing anything for what I'm trying to accomplish and what we need. So with that, I'll just...
Well, I appreciate that.
Go to my other meeting.
I think that question of charitable gaming is very much on our minds in the statute, that we need to think about it. And so what you're saying is, in your bill, you proposed the development of two destinations, casinos, and provided, had no provision in there for charitable gaming. Within those casinos, charitable gaming could go on as it might. Outside of that framework, it might be affected, it might not be, but your focus was on the two destination casinos. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. I have just gotten back from the Quebec, and I got your email, and I got my own trade council meeting, but this took priority because this represents a lot more people than the trade council. Right?
Okay, thanks so much. All right, I think we're on to the omnibus amendment to Senate Bill 152. We do have copies here. Thank you.
Hudson and Pelham. She served since 2004 and is currently an adjunct professor of computer and information systems at UNH. She served on both the science and tech committee and on the finance committee in the House for more years than she probably likes to admit. Then also with me is Representative David Hewitt, who is again technically a freshman in the House of Representatives this year, although David served previously in the 70s as a member of the finance committee, which he serves on now. David also is a retired justice of the Laconia District Court, where he served from 1979 until 2012. Just so you will have a little background of kind of where we're coming from. What we're presenting to you today is what's called the Omnibus Amendment. The reason it's called that is that the House, when Senate Bill 152 came to the House, it was referred to a joint committee, both members of finance and the administration. That committee is separated into three separate subcommittees, one dealing specifically with regulation, one dealing with revenue, and one dealing with community impact. As a result of those two committees coming together, there were a group of us, a bipartisan group of 10 representatives actually that signed on to co-sponsor this amendment. We were a group of individuals that looked at this situation and the number of issues that were raised, that it was our responsibility to find solutions to those issues. Not just point them out, but actually try to find solutions and work forward to bring forth another source of revenue for the state. That's how this amendment came about. What we're going to do today is kind of, each of us are going to highlight certain sections and talk about points, but then open it up for broader questions to you, and you're more than happy to answer those. And I'm going to start out by letting Representative Hewitt, who chaired the regulation subcommittee of the Joint Committee.
Good morning. My name is Dave Hewitt. I'm from Laconia. And I have the privilege of setting up the regulation subcommittee of the Joint Committee along with Dave Hester sitting back here. Jump up and scream if I say something wrong. The first thing I'd like to do is provide a little bit of context for how we happen to get to where we are sitting here this morning. Senate Bill 152, as you all know, was passed by Senator D'Alessandro. It was passed by the Senate in March, and we got the bill, just about the time the ink was dry on people's federal income tax returns. And at that point, we had until mid-May to do the work that was necessary. The work that was necessary was substantial. For example, right at the beginning, before we actually did any work, some of us sat down and said, oh, wait a minute, none of us know very much about gambling. And we don't know that much about creating regulations. So, in essence, we don't know what we don't know, how we would find out. We didn't have time, and we didn't have the ability to seek expert advice because we didn't have money. And of course, we were galled somewhat by the fact that RSA 284A, which you people are kind of a follow on to, provided some money and also provided the means to get the expert advice. And in fact, the committee put out RFPs and selected people, went to the Governor's Council, and the Executive Council voted them down. So we missed an opportunity to get some expert advice that would have really illuminated the process that we were involved in. Faced with that, we have to do the best we could. I want to say that I'm really proud of the people who served on the Joint Committee. This was truly a joint effort, and it was truly nonpartisan. There was no partisan bickering. It was like, I like to call it the old days. I was here in the old days. I was here from 71 to 75. And the kinds of discussions that we had then were the kinds of discussions that we had going forward with this committee. What our charge was, and I guess what your charge is as well, is the integrity of the process. Regulation involves making sure that the whole process is honest, and that the money, and there's a huge amount of money generated, but the money actually goes where it's supposed to. And we, in the regulation subcommittee, we focused on that. We didn't get into any of the revenue issues. Representative Kirk and Representative Spratt had tried to that, and we didn't deal with some of the hard issues, like what does casino gambling do to the quality of life? What does it do for families? What does it do to people who have a gene for being addicted to gambling? We had Representative Lumdra and Representative Ford with the community impact. So we labored for a month, and I feel we were fortunate in having Representative Ames, Representative Hugo, people who were on what I like to call the Rump Committee. The Rump Committee is the group that put together the Omnibus Amendment. It was impossible, even if our charge included it, it was impossible for the Joint Committee on a formal basis to develop an amendment that would deal with the things that we found that needed to be done. Really pleased that Representative Ames and his group were able to get that done, and that I was able to participate to some degree after the committee process was over. Some of the problems that we have encountered, and I'm not, we have a list of sections of the bill. I'm not going to talk about all the sections of the bill. I figured that some of you people may have one or two questions. And I want to make sure that you find out what you want to know, not what I know. But one of the things that immediately came to mind was the timelines. Timelines were constricted. There's a reason for that. You have to understand the context in which Central 152 came to pass. And that was that the governor had included in her budget presentation sums of money in each year of the current biennium we're in now, as revenue for the state. And of course, revenue from casino gambling or from anything else doesn't happen until it starts. So there was pressure, institutional pressure, to get the job done and to get the whole thing up and running as quickly as possible. That made the job a little more difficult. In fact, the timelines we found were so constricted that it probably would work. One of the things that we quickly discovered was, the Attorney General had 120 days in which to vet all of the people who want to work in this single casino. Well, what happened was there were five applicants times the number of people that are involved for each, the Attorney General is going to have to spend one awful pile of money or a lot of time to vet all these people and come up with a reasonable conclusion as to whether these people are appropriate for handling the kind of money that's involved in a casino operation. A couple of members of the Finance Committee informally backed some numbers up just to get a general idea of how much money was involved with one casino, and they both came up with approximately the same number that we're talking about in the course of the year, upwards of $5 billion changing hands back and forth. That is the drop was what is left after everybody finishes gambling. The total amount of money that runs through the system is huge. And so the integrity of that process is really important. So the timeline was something that needed to be dealt with. The omnibus amendment deals with those to a certain degree. Instead of expanding the timelines, the omnibus amendment provides a mechanism whereby time could be extended. Another challenge that we had that we didn't address in kind of a formal way was the notion that in order to be subject to scrutiny, somebody who was part of the ownership interest of a casino would have to own 10%. We had no idea what the average was, say, around the country. There are a lot of casinos. They have a lot of owners and representative rank. Found out a lot of them have similar ownership. But we couldn't determine easily whether 10% ownership was sufficient. And anecdotally, we found that 10% was probably pretty high, that people who control less than 10% of a corporation frequently have controlling interest, basically, in the corporation. That's particularly true in the business sector, the garment industry, and things like that. So that was something we had to address, and basically what came out in the omnibus amendment, 5%, is a compromise. A compromise between what we all kind of knew wasn't appropriate and what we settled upon being something that we could talk. I have my notes. I have tons of stuff I can talk about. Kathy was nice enough to give us a schedule and sections she wanted to hit. And I'm sure that the three of us can hit all of them. And we lived this for a month, day and night. I can show you emails that I had that came in at 3 o'clock in the morning. But I think what I'd rather do is find out what you need to know about what the legislature did in regard to Senate Bill 152 that can help you with your process. I do want to say that the action that you were taking this morning when I got to it, over the RFP and getting professional help, I think is critical. If you're going to protect the integrity of the state treasury and the integrity of the government process, you have to know what to do. And to do it without getting somebody who knows the regulation of gaming outside. If people who know it very well from the inside, we have Charlie, we have Tim, we have Paul. But it's always nice to have somebody who isn't connected with the operation to look at it and say, okay, this is what you think you need. Now, the rulemakers have to probably save you a lot of time. But of course, you folks have great luxury. You have until the sun. I can say that. I'm sure Representative Ames just dying over there, beating over the head. Of course you don't. Compared to the time that we had, you had time to do some things that we weren't able to do. And so I urge you folks to focus greatly on the process and making sure that there's a great deal of integrity in the system. I've read the minutes of your organizational meeting, and you to many, many things. Somebody that work for it, somebody that don't. But I think if you start with the concept that you're going to create a framework that will ensure the integrity of the process and the integrity of the money, that you'll come up with a lot closer to having a situation where, if it's definitely not a foregone conclusion, come after this article on 52. If you haven't come to the point where there is a casino or multiple casinos in New Hampshire, you will at least have a framework that you know you can depend on to keep the whole thing safe. That is your charge. We don't have a casino now, but if we do, it's always going to have a time constraint to it that's not going to allow you to start from scratch. You have to start from scratch plus.
Good morning. My name is Lynn Omer. Many of you know my favorite state rep, Russ Over, who sits on one knee. He also flew for the Air Force. So I'm perhaps one of the few people in this room who has lived in Las Vegas. Russ was stationed at Nellis Air Force Base, which is a tactical air command training center for pilots in Las Vegas. My son went to elementary schools there. My son went to public schools all his life, managed to go to MIT on a full scholarship because his grades were so high, because the schools in Las Vegas were so good. Graduated with a double major in 4 years, which is almost never heard of down at MIT. I lived in Las Vegas with my doors unlocked all the time. People would tell you, oh, crime everywhere. I could go to the grocery store in Las Vegas at 9 o'clock at night and not worry about being mugged. I live in Hudson, 23,000 people. I don't go to the grocery store at night. I'm worried about being mugged. A block away from my house, house was broken in 3 weeks ago, all the copper pipes stolen out of it. There's crime in our community. I used to get on a bike with my friends and ride to a Las Vegas casino and have lunch for a couple of bucks and then ride home. It was great, cheap entertainment. So when I listen to people talk about all the crime it brings, I live there. I don't have that experience. It's not the only place I've lived. I've lived in Thailand. I lived in Germany. Yeah, I've lived with crime. But in Las Vegas, I didn't live with that. So Representative Ames, Hewitt, and Rogers asked me to join on the omnibus amendment that we presented. Unfortunately, we were not allowed to debate in the Joint Committee, nor did we debate on the floor. But one of the things I learned in the Joint Committee is I know why I'm fat. It was said over and over. If you live within 10 miles of a casino, you will become a problem gambler. I'm here to tell you, I live within 10 miles of a grocery store. I'm clearly a problem because I'm over crazy. They hope I'm going to speak English about computers. One of the things about being married to someone in the Air Force, we moved fairly frequently. Russ always had a job. I always had to get another job. So I worked in the industry a lot. And after I retired, as Roger said, I am now teaching on the faculty in the computer science program at UNH, where I can share my love of the profession with other people and help raise the next people. We have a lot of information in this bill that relates to a central computerized system. Many of you probably know that 3 budget cycles ago, we installed an enterprise resource planning system starting with the budget. The last 2 budget cycles, we have done everything we can to consolidate the back office operations, which is saving us money. This continues the use of that computer technology that we've already proven to be very sound and safe in our state, and we'll be able to talk about that. And as Rep. Hewitt said, we are available to answer questions, we can go through sections, Representative Rogers, I'm going to turn it over to you and to you tell us how you'd like it to proceed.
Well, I want to talk about a few different parts of it before we open the a few of the problems that we were told existed with bringing the government to New Hampshire was, one, that it would be undue influence on the political spectrum of the state, two, that it would be crime rampant, and then three, the problems with minors. And I'd like to speak to how those are included in this bill. First of all, one of the things that we looked at when we made the requirements was the application process, the request for application process and the approval. We used that as kind of a carrot and stick approach, I guess you would say, because it's the regulatory part of it. In that one of the questions was, and one of the things people brought up, that all of these supposed jobs would go out of state. So we looked at how we can in fact influence that and look to something that's been used for a long time in the United States, which is affirmative action. And gold. What is done is it doesn't say you have to hire this percent of New Hampshire workers or you have to hire this percent of minority or whatever. But part of what the group that Judge Kuhn did the license has to look at is there a plan, a workforce development plan? Does that plan have training for New Hampshire workers? Does it offer an incentive to whoever the licensee has already been contracted to hire New Hampshire workers? And then how would they do that? So they don't have, they can't just say, oh yeah, we're going to hire New Hampshire workers. They have to show in that RFP how they're going to recruit and hire New Hampshire workers and what percent, what group they're going to aim at. So there's incentive, if they want to get that license, they're going to have the best plan to recruit New Hampshire workers and to not only recruit them in the construction stage, but to recruit them once the casino is operational and to train them so it would be an ongoing workforce. Also within that are some other things such as we've asked that they have a plan of how they're going to provide daycare for not only their employees but for patrons. So that we use that part of the regulations and say what is included in the RFP and how it's judged by the Commission of Urban Regulatory to put in some goals that we want to try to approach on a policy standpoint. It's something that's been used by the United States government and by our state government a lot. And we included that into the bill. That was a new part. With regards to crime, one of the things, having been a former prosecutor, one of the things that I noticed is that we didn't relate it back to the criminal code. And in talking with Judge Hewitt and other members of the committee, we all found that was a problem, twofold actually. There's also nothing was taking away the crime of gambling. So if we licensed a casino, technically everybody there would be committing a crime unless we change that. So in this bill, there's a part that removes the fact that it's a criminal offense if you're at a casino gambling. It's a licensed casino that's allowable. But we also referenced over specific gambling crimes that included them into the criminal code. Those included things like cheating and swindling, fraudulent gambling, using devices that are, I'm sure that even the safety representative would admit, the new devices come up with every day. People come up with new ways to cheat and swindle people. And on gambling technology, while there's a lot that's done to make it secure, there's always new devices coming up. So this bill specifically talks to those crimes and how to move forward. We actually, Attorney Paul Toomey, who serves as a legal counsel to the Speaker, actually helped us also as well as making sure that it melded well with the criminal code. But we talked, we went through what's a felony, what would be a misdemeanor, and we had progressive crimes. So that if you, for instance, sell or allow a minor to gamble, knowingly allow a minor to gamble, the first time is one offense, the second time it progresses up. So that there's an incentive that maybe you do it once and it's a mistake, but you make real sure that you or your employees are not doing it again. So we tried to make sure that those elements of the criminal aspect were included into something that had been lacking in previous bills. As far as the minors gambling, there was a question because as the folks from charitable gaming know, they do allow 18-year-olds to do it. We've decided, we had a lot of debate on this in the whole committee and among the group sponsors, that the best way to do it was to exclude anyone under the age of 21 from gambling. That they could not go to a casino. They could not even go to the charitable part of the casino if that existed. Now, other venues that have charitable gaming, that was not effective. It was specific casinos licensed under this, no one under 21. We talked about should there be separate entrances, should we segregate the part, that part of the casino, and we came up with all kinds of issues. It would be difficult to deal with, specifically law enforcement as well, to do that. So our decision was to exclude
you're not 21, you're not going to gamble. However, there is a provision in there that if you're an employee, if you're a wait service person or something in the casino, and you're a licensed employee, you are allowed to be there from 18 to 21. So there's that, similar to what there are in bars right now, that people can go in. The last section I'll speak to is the political contributions. In some background, a little more background on me, prior to becoming an attorney, I served as a, I guess I should call it a political consultant, is the word I was considered, I was a political hack. I traveled around the country. I've been in most all of the 50 states, working for candidates, running campaigns, raising money, and so forth. So I am very good at knowing how to get around political contributions, how to work the system, to stay within the law, but there's always things around. So who better to look at how to write a political contribution prohibition? What I did was take examples from a number of other states, worked with some folks, but came up with a very, very tough limit on political contributions. Basically, what it means is if you are a licensee, if you're a son, a daughter, a mother, a father, a brother, a sister, a wife, if you work for, if you're an employee, if you're a lobbyist, if you're in any way beholding to anything having to do with the casino, you cannot contribute to political candidates or elected officials in the state of New Jersey. So it's across the board, you can't do it. There are pretty substantial penalties if you were found making that contribution. We decided to have a very large penalty of $20,000 per illicit donation, plus the amount of each donation, and that there would be penalties and sanctions that could come forward by the Lottery Commission, which we have as a regulatory body. So there's a real incentive not to try to get around the system, and it includes third parties, so other paths that are contributing to the system. We've also, as Representative Hewitt talked about, in the bill, we say 5% to investigate your background check. In the political contribution section, if you hold any more than 1%, or you hold 1% or above, you're prohibited. So it's very, very strong. And that was a thing that was agreed on by most people. We need to be very strong. One of the arguments that people made that were concerned about casino gambling was the influence that it would have on the state. In a small state, the number of races in the House and the Senate, that they could influence them easily. But this also goes beyond House and the Senate, obviously includes executive council and governor, but includes local town officials as well, so you can't buy the board selecting or city council. It does not include the federal offices, because by law we cannot do that. That's regulated on federal level. So could somebody come in and buy a senator or a congressman? Probably, but it didn't do them a whole lot of good if it's being regulated by the state of New Hampshire. The other two things quickly I'm going to say is there was also provisions put in for the ability of the state police to regulate at the casino. The way our current law is, and I'm sure that Cindy can explain this better, but the state police cannot go into certain communities unless they're invited. There's statutorily some places they can and can't go. This would allow for them to be able to go in and assist and conduct and help with investigations in the local area. So that's something that the Department of Safety brought forward and included in the amendment. Those are kind of some quick highlights. I think we can open up to questions. We would be glad to answer whatever you have. And I think for all of us, if there's questions later, we're more than happy if you give them to us to get back to you. As you said, we would love to talk about this. We were allowed to present the amendment to the Joint Committee. However, it was never allowed to be debated, and it was never debated on the floor. So we love talking about it because we didn't have enough of an opportunity at the time.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes. It looks like you did a great amount of work here and improved the bill quite a bit. But in Representative Hewitt's opening remarks, he said he wished he had a consultant to assist. And we have that lecture. We'll have that lecture shortly. Do you feel that you had the time to assess, for example, whether the Lottery Commission is the best place to place this, or you know, if that's sort of there already and the decision was kind of made for you, you can only do so much?
That is debated a lot about where it should go. Some of us, and I'll let Dave speak this because he's chairman of the committee a little bit, some of us felt the Lottery Commission was very able to handle it. Others thought it should be broader and looked at. One of the provisions in here, none of us talked about, but it's in there, kind of you guys. It extended the committee, but it gave it a few years of life to look at if we started with the audit commission, maybe look at us working and see if it's something we want to transition. But David was coming more about that discussion.
I actually addressed that at one of the meetings. I think it's going to be a presentation of the committee. Who should be in charge of developing this whole process? There were very strong opinions on both sides. The lottery commission should be in charge, but it should be a separate commission to do it. The lottery commission is a part-time volunteer operation. Get some money, but it's like the executive council. Take a look at Ray Burton, you know, money he gets the money, look, he does the predictions. And the lottery commission is basically the same thing. To put a large operation on top of that raises some problems just in terms of the ability of the volunteers to spend the time doing the necessary work. Paul Holloway is on the lottery commission. Mr. Holloway has a large business. He has a lot of things on his plate. And Mr. Holloway also volunteers for other things than just a lottery. He's an active person in the community and the state. And is it fair? One of the issues is it fair to put that kind of a operation on top of what these people are going to do? And that's completely without debating whether it's appropriate or whether you know the process to be fair and impartial and all that. Just the mere fact that you're saying, well, all right, the lottery commission will do it. And I continue to maintain that that's an issue that needs to be considered at the highest levels of state government. So the appropriate decision is made, you know, without saying the lottery commission.
However, Mr. McIntyre is more than qualified to lead this type of division. And A.G. Foster, your own branch of government came to budget hearings this year. I sit on Division 1. I sat on the Revenue Subcommittee when we looked at SB 152. Your own division came and said, we don't have enough people to adequately do our job, and we want to add this division. Now, I have not heard that you decided not to add that. I think that would be a big news story. So, is the Lottery Commission, as it is structured, going to need some additional help? I think the answer is definitively yes. Can Mr. McIntyre lead this process given his background? I think the answer is also definitively yes. When people say, should we have a separate commission, what they're really saying is, should we have more hands, more qualified hands? And that's part of what you need to look at. Should we have more qualified hands? TRA asked for 35 full-time equivalents in this year's budget. So DRA came and said, we are not competent to raise revenue if you don't give us 35 hands. But did we say we have somebody at the top who can lead them? Safety says we need 10 more state troopers. We can't do the work. Did they say we're incompetent? No. They said, give us the people. We have the leadership. We're going to make this happen. So that is the other side of this, and that's what you have to concentrate on, I think, is not whether it should be one new commission, but are we adding the appropriate people to get the mission done? And yes, this will increase people. So you guys have to deal with that. That's just one other view that I would like you to keep track of, because I have ultimate faith that you're going to lead that new unit to do exactly what we wanted. Just as I believe the 10 new people in safety, the state troopers are going to do what we wanted, and the 35 people who went into the revenue administration. Hands are needed, competent hands are needed, without a doubt.
On the resource side, the bill has amended, or as you proposed it to be amended, put a lot of responsibility into the Department of Justice. Are there resources that are contemplated by the amendment that would be added? Is that what you're talking about, a unit? Because I'm not sure what you're referring
there
to.
There is financial in section B22.
For background checks, I know there are.
No, in section B22, where they're talking about distribution of net machine income, which is beyond background check. That assumes it's going. When they look at net machine income.
What page are you on?
I just got your amendment this morning, so it's section B22. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
That happens to be the distribution of net machine income where it talks about money that will be put in, and section 1A starts with 25% of net machine income generated by video lottery machines goes to the commission, and then it specifies how the commission will distribute that. And Attorney General Foster, one of those pieces is unfunded AG costs. So you will be asked to keep your records and get your money back. So yes, profits are from the machine designated to come to your agency. And I would assume if you're the Attorney General at the time, you would be the one who would decide what hands would be needed and how that would be spent. The bill is silent on that, leaving that to the agency head.
What page, I'm sorry?
26, line 14.
Yes.
I'm going to get into something a little more specific on a different topic. How did the pieces about the nonprofit venues come into being? And also the definition of nonprofit venues is it looks to me, for example, that the Verizon in Manchester is included, although it's managed and by private agency. It's not more public-private. It's not really nonprofit. There's a lot of profit made by the management company. So how did that come about? I'm curious.
I'm going to tell you that your chairman is probably the best one to answer because that was the section he worked hard on. But basically, it came about in that a number of venues, from the King Theater to the Concord Capital Center to many others, came with a concern that they would specifically lose out on booking. That one of the practices on a number of casinos, various national ones, was to once they signed a particular entertainer, to block them out that they could not come within a certain radius or a certain size. So that was when we started to look at the problem. We tried to take in as much as we could, again, on that original plan that the RFP, that there had to be a meeting with those venues, that they had to try to work out an agreement, and that there were some terrible sick things to do that. But I've got to profess that I think the best person that maybe when you come across this, that Resident Ames was the one that worked exclusively on that section and had a lot of the information on it, but was taken with that idea in mind to try to have them work with them so we could make it as tight as possible. Unfortunately, we couldn't take in all of the for-profit, but there is a provision that they have to consider and talk to them. And I guess our goal was to have a conversation at least between the venues. We had heard from various people representing hospital casinos that they would do this and so forth, and this is trying to put it into those statutes and the law. So
that's good. Thank you.
Try to answer that.
Yeah, if your question relates to the nonprofit, for profit line, my recollection is that we were uncomfortable getting a leg up to the for profit. Mm-hmm. Side of that line, but fully comfortable with giving some special status to the nonprofits that were in the entertainment business, and that's the origin of that.
Thank you.
Yes.
I wanted to go back to some of Representative Gober's comments and maybe some of Representative Hewitt's as well about the structure and it seems what I'm grappling with is I very much appreciate the practicality of getting the job done. Do we have the people who are here who are capable of getting the job done, and what extra resources do they need in order to get a larger job done? But I think for us, or for me particularly, we need to look at several different levels, one of which is that we have an enormous number of very capable individuals here, both at the table and also beyond the table, who are in jobs, doing them well, and who people have confidence in. But for me, one needs to make a distinction between the very capable individuals who are doing particular jobs right now and whether those capable individuals can be used within a structure that may be different from what we have now, but that may make more sense. And I'm kind of picking up on what Attorney Sullivan said in terms of if you have three separate categories of gaming going on, one being the lottery, which we already have, one being the charitable racing, which we already have, and one being or not being extended, it seems to me almost axiomatic that the regulator would be something that would be a separate entity that regulates all three, and whether that is the same individuals in different positions, it seems to me that that needs to be separated out, and I just wondered what discussions you've had with respect to that when you were drafting the omnibus amendment, when you were considering other things to the committee.
If your chairman drafted the amendment, so he probably should talk about what he considered when he was drafting the amendment.
Put it back on me.
And I may be premature. I mean, that may be a discussion that this whole committee needs to have at another time. I just...
Well, that's largely right. But I do want to say that I think this should be self-evident that we're not in the business of creating a structure around existing personalities and individuals. We're trying to create the best possible structure. Whether that structure works off of the existing system and still has some gaming over here and some gaming over here and not an overarching entity or not will depend on the outcome of the information that we gather through this process. We're going to have an expert gaming consultant to help us look at the other states. The statute charges us for looking at other states, and we're going to learn a lot from that, how they do it. And how they do it is not how we're going to do it. I mean, New Hampshire always does it its own way. But we're going to learn from that process and make some judgments.
Representative Weber, if you move away from how the amendment was written to just the situation, I would suggest to you, and I know this is a constant conversation in finance because we talk about duplicative services. Don't have duplicative services because then you have more money to pay for X. I mean, you're always trying to move your resources around. You do that at home, we do that here in the state. Do we need a lottery commission and a racing and charitable gaming agency? I don't know the answer to that. But again, I did not write this amendment. I'm just talking about if we went forward, would it make sense to have an overarching commission with multiple directorates under it, which you see clearly in the Liquor Commission where they've got a huge police force and enforcement. They also do their purchasing, and we have other overarching legislation. DRA also is in that range. They do more than just pick up tax revenues. They decide whether warrant articles are legal. I mean, we've done some of that. When you have your expert helping you, I think that's a time to look at best organization, and that's outside of how the amendment was written. And all due respect to the chairman, I think he did a great job writing the amendment, but just if I were sitting on this committee, I would be looking at what would be the best overall way to organize, and I would ask somebody outside who's had some experience in that and then make adjustments as appropriate within an amendment. I think Representative Hewitt was clear we would have loved to have had a consultant. We did not.
I can say there's a group of probably four or five of us that worked closely with in writing this. The discussions when we talked about this section were very much that we felt comfortable with the lottery commission operating in the casino club and regulating it. for a number of reasons. One, the similarities between machines and how the technology that they deal with at this time. The fact that in other states, it has been done, it's not particularly unusual to have a large machine running. But we also, as I mentioned, one of the parts from the end of the bill talks about an ongoing commission. This commission that appears is that commission right now. But that we start out the process with it regulated by the lottery commission if, over the course of the first few years operating, this commission and looking at the operation finds that it would be more efficient, more practical, or whatever, to combine the different sources of gambling in the state, or to have a new, entirely new body regulate, that that's something that can be brought forward. But again, New Hampshire, like a small government, we don't necessarily like building new divisions, new empires, if you will. And when we were first drafting this, I think that that's how the discussion came down. We all felt very comfortable for a nimble beast in having it come under the auspices of the Lottery Commission. But we had a provision that if change needed to happen, there would be a body that would be looking at it, someone independently, that would come back to the legislature and say, hey, maybe we need to tweak this or change this. So I think that was the initial discussion that's been why we have it. Thank you.
To follow up on this line of discussion, one of the concerns that I remember being expressed when we were going through that regulations subcommittee process was that there were insufficient checks, balances on the entity, the Lottery Commission, that was given the primary, the lead gaming regulatory authority. Could any of you speak to sort of that principle and trying to respond to that principle and what we tried to do within this proposed amendment?
I think that the reason that, and I spoke about the elephant in the room, and the reason that that wasn't going to become a huge issue is that the Lottery Commission is very confident in what it does, and Mr. McIntyre is probably one of the most confident guys in the field. So not having the time to deal with all the issues that needed to be dealt with, I think the consensus was, all right, we can let this go because we have a structure there that can do the work. And government reorganization is something that happens every term of the legislature. And if you need to augment the Lottery Commission or change who's in charge or appoint a new commission, it's a simple matter of writing a bill. What we were concerned with is like talking about the integrity of the process. And we did not fear the integrity of the process from the Lottery Commission. What we feared is overwork. And when you're overworked, you make mistakes.
I think there was another element of it. I just chime in on this checks and balances piece. That we tried to build into the amendment that we'll have to go through this more thoroughly later on because we're going to run out of time shortly. But appeals, the opportunity to appeal adverse decisions, we tried to address that both judicially and administratively, and the role of the Attorney General's office vis-a-vis versus or in parallel to the Lottery Commission, the role of the State Police, the Legislative Budget Assistance Office, and auditing function. All these things were designed to get at that core principle that you mentioned at the beginning that's in our statute, and that is to ensure as much as possible the integrity of this entire operation. So I just put that out there. If you want to say more about those elements that I mentioned that haven't been mentioned yet, please do.
I think that you all highlighted, and as Secretary Amy said, we were very cognizant of, again, using the caring stick approach on the applications for license, where you go into having to appear and work with the localities as you go through the whole process for permitting, building, and all this kind of thing. The AG's powers are extended, and I think it's on page 5, section 9-11 starts with the authority of the Attorney General, but we were not previously given the bill to extend the power. I think that the judge was probably a conservatorship question that was brought up as well.
Any Did you mention that? Go into that for a moment, the conservatorship. That's something we haven't talked about.
That was to do with an operator or a bankrupt. Frank Davis does an incredible amount of research on this. And one of the things that happens, the operator goes bankrupt, and the operation goes down the tubes. There's nobody to run it. And so it was thought that if we created a conservatorship, that it would permit the operation to continue while all of the issues like bankruptcy and things like that continue. We couldn't suspend the license because of bankruptcy, but having a conservatorship available to keep the operation going, that was less within the realm of the regulations of the committee rather than the subcommittee. Because obviously, what you're trying to do with that is to keep money forward. But from the point of view of regulation, most of the stuff pertaining to the law kind of fell into the wildly failure. The other thing I want to add is it occurred to me that one of the things that kind of runs through Senate Bill or the Ombudsman was the notion that they didn't want to get the courts involved. If the courts get involved, things slow down. And that just happens to be true. Very good reasons for it comes true. And I was thinking, for instance, particularly in terms of the Attorney General's investigation of people, the Attorney General's office comes up with a recommendation. There isn't anything in the law that gives anybody an opportunity to question any of the factual determinations that were made by the Attorney General, other than to go to the Supreme Court. And that just seems to me like kind of an onerous process designed to even waste more time than to have a simple procedure whereby an applicant, for example, who the Attorney General found one of their key people was corrupt, to at least question the factual basis for that determination. That's neither here nor there, but that's another part of the whole process of making decisions. Taking the time to make the decision right, and not just the only place you can go in the middle is the Supreme Court. There should be some internal process that to avoid all that, the expense, the time, and all that.
Good point.
Mr. Chairman, one thing we have mentioned that is different from the bill that came over from the Senate is that we did amend it in the House so that the total investment by the successful applicant would have to be $425 million. But that is going to exclude the cost of the license, exclude the land purchase, and exclude any infrastructure. While we, as we worked on this, were in favor of a casino, we did not want to have an expensive concrete block parlor where people said, oh, you know, in finance, it's going to cost you money. It's going to be awesome. We did not want people to say, well, I spent $400 million on roads and infrastructure, so now I'm going to put up a concrete block structure. We tightened that. It continues to be tightened in here, and I know that Representative Rogers is looking through there and trying to find the exact page and number in case you ask that question. Oh, she's digging for her.
But a question for Representative Rogers back on the criminal code changes. Just background on the information you looked at, whether you looked at other states.
I tried to look at other states to see the specific gambling offenses, because obviously we have no need for them here, and looked at things that were added in. Obviously, within the criminal code already are the public nuisance crimes that the Representative Stacey had mentioned, disorderly conduct, robbery, theft, any kind of assault. So any kind of criminal action is already in the code and already been applicable there. So the new parts that were added were specifically to gambling offenses, such as, and most of those come around the fraud, swindling and cheating, I think is what it's called in those places. So most of them came under that. The other one section that I think we didn't talk about was and to take a little bit away from, you know, having to the lottery to make decisions that have been clearly in statute was for transferring a license. That was a question that was brought up also a great deal, is how easy is to transfer and kind of stop only coming, so to speak, and get the license and then quickly transfer it to someone. So you'll see that there's some very tight provisions on what has to happen if that transfer occurs. So we try to take away that issue as well. As I said when we began, what we tried to do was listen intently to all of the concerns and issues that people brought up. And while we didn't address everything, it's impossible. One thing that you can find is kind of like a coat that you pull one string and another keeps coming. But that's like with a number of things. We regulate liquor successfully, but I think we always find that there's changes. We regulated a number of other things in the state. It's a constantly evolving thing. I myself have been involved in dealing with social media. It's something that's new and we wouldn't have thought of maybe even 2 years ago, but we have new things coming up. So I would caution you to try to put forward something that's going to solve every issue and regulate every single problem, because you can't. There's going to be something new. Every time you find a way to prevent something from happening, someone will find another way to make it happen. So I would caution you, we're finding ourselves, I mean, I know I've had a string of emails that we represent Hubert, we represent Ogle, we represent Haynes, that were timelined at like 3:30 a.m. because I would wake up in the middle of the night and think of, oh my God, what if this happens? So you can make yourself crazy very easily if you try to solve every single problem. So I would caution you that there isn't every answer in this. There won't be. And no matter what we do, I think that we'll ever have the perfect solution that will regulate any problem that may occur. But we attempted to take the ones that were brought up step by step and deal with them instead of just throwing away the baby that far, I guess, is the term.
Okay, well, on that note, unless there's an urgent, yes, Senator Rush.
I guess I would like to follow up on that. If Senator Ross, you're absolutely correct. I think this is my 13th year up here. It's going to be very, very difficult to look back and find a perfect piece of legislation. We have administrative rules because we attempt to fill a void that the legislature might have missed. We pass it, we amend it, we change it. There is no such thing as a perfect piece of legislation that anticipated everything. If there were, we wouldn't have to be up here every year. So you cannot see. Right now, we're paralyzed by trying to resolve every single issue. Some of it is because the people who don't want it want to create situations that they do paralyze the process because they want it defeated. But I believe at this point we're in a race for time to get something so that we can remain competitive as a state. Massachusetts is going to get something. If we want to lose all this revenue, we could be paralyzed. We're going to hire experts. At some point you have to have faith in your attorney general, the racing, the lottery, the state police, and they, if there is that void in the legislation, they are astute enough to be able to determine what that void is and we can correct it. Boeing spent billions and billions of dollars to design the Dreamliner. If they wanted it, if it had to be absolutely perfect, you'd never see it. They had to put it out there and test fly it. We need to test fly this thing. They did find out a defect with the lithium battery. Guess what? They fixed it. We can fix this. We need to fly. Thank you.
And on that note, I want to thank you, each of you, for your help as we move forward.
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you for having us here. And I want to say one more thing from my personal experience. Remember, I'm the one who lived in Las Vegas. Russ was an Air Force officer. On our block, Russ and I were the only people paying a mortgage. All the rest of the people worked for the casinos and paid cash for their houses. We were the poor people. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And as I said, we're more than happy if there's questions, representatives, stay forward to them, and we'll be glad to hear them.
Well, I would say it goes both ways. We have the benefit of your presence and testimony. But if you forgot to say something, if something comes up as we go along, we need to hear from you. And it doesn't have to be face-to-face. We can take letters, emails. communications in that way.
Thank you so much.
Senator D'Alessandro, I see you managed to get here from your other meeting.
Thank you.
I think we have got copies of your bill, so we're just going to hand those around.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, while you're passing out the bill, I'd like you to recognize a friend of mine in the audience is a retired state trooper from the state of Massachusetts and retired Secretary of Public Safety for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, James Jujuba.
James
Jujuba.
Thank you.
You just tell me when you're ready.
We're almost ready.
You can have mine. I've got a...
Oh, okay. I'll give it all my product.
Okay,
thanks,
Paul. You need more here. Obviously, I don't
want to. I have a number.
Okay. Kathy Hoffman telling me to step down. Why don't we go ahead? You're all set.
Thank you. Thank you. First of all, many thanks for giving me the opportunity to appear before you. I brought some of the 25 amendments that were talked about but never considered by the House. I'm sure you've all read them thoroughly and have digested them. I've got a prepared statement, and then I'll be more than happy to address any query that you might have. I've been a proponent of this expanded gaming legislation for 16 years, have proposed it each biennium for the last 8. We've passed it in the Senate 3 times. It has been not accepted by the House. So thank you for the opportunity to address the committee regarding Senate Bill 152. As you know, the bill passed the Senate with bipartisan support and was subsequently defeated in the House. I'll give an overview of the bill as passed by the Senate and would be happy to answer any questions you might have. Senate Bill 152 allowed video lottery and table gaming at one gaming location in the state, which would be licensed pursuant to a competitive application process. The gaming location would be authorized to operate up to 5,000 video lottery machines and up to 150 table games. The bill established a schedule to distribute the state's proceeds of the video lottery machines to the funding of highways, roads, bridges, and including the widening of I-93. There is no question, that our bridges are in terrible shape. We have 325 red line bridges. We haven't really completed the construction of I-93. It hangs in abeyance as we speak, and our paving has been de minimis over the past number of bienniums. Some of the money is dedicated to higher education, and a component goes to the North Country for economic development. Money is also allocated to the municipalities abutting the site and to the site where the approval has been granted, the site where the gaming facility is located. We also set aside money for alcohol and drug abuse treatment and for problem gaming. The bill required that 14% of the daily gross table game revenue be distributed to the Education Trust. The bill required that the Lottery Commission to license and regulate the installation, operation, and conduct of video lottery machines and table games, and established a gaming enforcement unit in the Division of State Police. We mirrored the gaming enforcement unit after the gaming enforcement unit established in the state of Delaware when they passed video lottery. I've been in constant contact with the director of the video lottery program in Delaware, Mr. Lemons, who has retired. He has now been replaced, but he was there when they introduced the video lottery. He was the head of the lottery commission and ran it quite successfully. The bill establishes process to allow video lottery and table gaming in a municipality following approval by referendum or vote in a town meeting, and establish a commission to study whether to recommend licenses at additional sites. All applicants would have been charged a non-refundable application fee of $500,000 to be used to defray the cost of processing applications, and if the processing cost exceeded $500,000, the applicant would pay the difference. There's been some concern about the number of people who apply for a license. Massachusetts has three licenses and one slot power. They had 11 applicants. Their fee was $400,000 non-refundable. So they had 11 people apply for three licenses. The applicant would also pay a non-refundable investigation fee of $100,000 to defray the cost of background investigation occurred by the Attorney General. And if the cost of the background investigation exceeded $100,000, the applicant would pay the difference. Once an applicant was chosen, they would pay an initial $80 million fee for the license. This license would expire after 10 years. It would be subject to renewal. The fee would be deposited in a fund established by RSA 284:21-j and made available to the state in the fiscal year it's received. The bill established a detailed process for gaming license applications, including extensive criminal history and financial background checks. It also required applicants to provide a detailed description of the proposed gaming project and specify what information must be supplied. It required an applicant to agree to make a minimum capital investment in the gaming project in the amount determined by the Lottery Commission. That number was not less than $425 million. The bill was crafted in a way that attempted to address concerns raised about previous gaming proposals, and also in a way that could enable New Hampshire to have its facilities functional prior to the Massachusetts facilities, thus establishing a competitive advantage. In essence, that's the content of the bill. You have the bill before you, and you can dissect the bill. As I say, there were a number of amendments that you can review to make the bill better. I've tried the bill 16 times, and I hope we've improved it every time. I am the Larry Pickett of the 21st century. Larry Pickett, of course, was the proponent of the lottery. He only had to try it 10 times. So I'm already 6 up. And he did get it passed before he passed. And the lottery has been fairly successful. We have been replicated in 38 other states. But we have the first in the nation lottery. We have the first lottery that was reconstituted after lotteries were abandoned in the 18th century. And by the way, Dartmouth College was founded by a lottery for educational purposes. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be more than happy to address any query that you might have and hope for the best. It's wonderful to have a commission to look at this. I think it's a viable entity. Just yesterday, we lost 200 more jobs in the state of New Hampshire with Vermont Yankee closing. There are 200 New Hampshire men who work there. Their average salary is $90,000 a year. They will have to be replicated. In the state, we lost 13 supermarkets. We lost 1,000 jobs, many of those in the southern part of the state. Those jobs will have to be replaced. So we do have a need for economic recovery and job creation. We do have a need for that. I don't think that you don't need a commission to roll that out. That's clear. That is clear at this point in time. And it's also clear that our neighboring states, Maine and Massachusetts, have either had gambling operations in place or are contemplating gambling operations. The Maine gambling occupation in Oxford sold for $160 million a couple of weeks ago. Initial investment was $49 million. That's a pretty good return on investment. So it was a successful entity, owned and operated by an entrepreneur who has New Hampshire roots. Massachusetts is contemplating their situation, and as we know, if you read yesterday's Globe, Mayor Menino has just completed a transaction with a vendor which pays the city of Boston $34 million a year in perpetuity and pays the town of East Boston, where I was born and brought up, $34 million as a one-time gift. Therein lies the premise, and as I said, I appreciate the opportunity to come before you, and I'll address any queries that you might have.
Senator Rush.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, I think I was remiss in not complimenting these representatives and all the individuals who worked on the omnibus amendment. I have looked at it. I believe it has defined better how we want our regulatory structure. And as I got off on all the legislation, I did not compliment. And so I think that is important. I think the House did a good job. I look forward to be able to move forward. And Senator DeLisandro has done the same. I have not asked him what he feels about the omnibus, but I will now.
Thank you very much, Senator Rush. Appreciate it. And as all of you, Senator Rush was a very positive compliment to Senator Rush that he drafted a portion of it. I think anything that makes the bill better is something that we all want, we all desire. We desire perfection. Is perfection attainable? I don't know. But we all desire that help. And I think, looking through the number of amendments that were proposed, and having spent some time talking to Representative Rogers, Representative Wolver, and Representative Hewitt, anything that makes the bill better is a good thing. I have been in these legislative halls for 40 years. I was first elected to the House in 1972. And I think I have never seen a perfect piece of legislation. So anything to help is a plus. Thank you.
Let me just ask you about the structure. The Senate Bill 152 goes to the Library Commission, so the lead gaming entity, and then there are other entities that have roles to play. Could you comment on that choice and options that you see?
Thank you for the question. In trying to reflect the bill, we tried to use an existing structure that we thought would be applicable in order to get this done expeditiously. The lottery is a method that's been used in other states, and it seemed to me using a prototype that's been successful was a good idea. I think a lot of things have happened in the 16 years that I've been proposing this bill. At one time, we had thoroughbred racing and we had greyhound racing in the state. Those have basically disappeared at this point in time. We were gearing legislation in that direction 16 years ago. Well, that's dissipated and it disappeared. So I think we can always improve, as I said, and make changes. We thought the lottery was a good start. The lottery's got a history. It's been around. I remember Ed Powers when he was first hired to run the first lottery here in the FBI agent, great credentials, swallowed the Brinks case. So that was a good choice. A good friend of mine, and God rest his soul, he did a really good job for us. So the lottery seemed like a good place. That's why we chose it, and that's why we agreed to change it in another direction. Trying to use an existing framework. What I've been working in my mind is looking at a framework that's in place someplace else that we could superimpose here. It's a thought process that I'm going through to try to make it better.
I guess we're engaged in that thought process too.
Right, sure. Well, I've had a lot of sleepless nights over the last 16 years.
Any other questions? You're getting off easy today. Many, many thanks.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. And I'm happy to return any time that I can be of service to the commission. I think we have, we obviously have a challenge, but I think we do have a timeline. And we're at a point where I think the decision-making process has to move forward.
Thank you. Any other business? Anything that any member wants to bring up? Hearing none, we are adjourned until the next session, which will be a public hearing.
We'll have the Tuesday session.
Tuesday session. That's why we're adjourned until our next session, which will become a executive or non-public session. And that session will be on September 10th, and then we'll move on September 12th to a public hearing. Both of those events will start at 9 in the morning. Thank you.